Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economic ecology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world.
Welcome to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Susan Orlean is the author of 10 books and numerous magazine articles. She's best known for her book, The Orchid Thief, which was the inspiration for the movie Adaptation, starring Meryl Streep as Susan. Her latest book, about the 1986 fire at the Los Angeles Public Library and libraries in general, is called The Library Book. Susan talks this hour with Anne Strainchamps, host and co-creator of the public radio program To the Best of Our Knowledge. Anne asked Susan to start off by reading from The Library Book.
I grew up in libraries, or at least it feels that way. I was raised in the suburbs of Cleveland, just a few blocks from the brick-faced Bertram Woods branch of the Shaker Heights Public Library System. Throughout my childhood, starting when I was very young, I went there several times a week with my mother. On those visits, my mother and I walked in together. But as soon as we passed through the door, we split up and each headed to our favorite section. The library might have been the first place I was ever given autonomy. Even when I was maybe 4 or 5 years old, I was allowed to head off on my own. Then after a while, my mother and I reunited at the checkout counter with our finds. Together, we waited as the librarian at the counter pulled out the date card and stamped it with the checkout machine, that giant fist thumping the card with a loud chunk chunk, printing a crooked due date underneath a score of previous crooked due dates that belonged to other people, other times. Our visits to the library were never long enough for me. The place was so bountiful. I love wandering around the bookshelves, scanning the spines until something happened to catch my eye. Those visits were dreamy, frictionless interludes that promised I would leave richer than I arrived. Should I keep going?
Yeah, a little bit more.
Okay. So I'm just gonna read a tiny bit more.
Tiny bit, because I love the part about when you and your mom leave the library together.
This wasn't like going to a store with my mom, which guaranteed a tug of war between what I wanted and what my mother was willing to buy me. In the library, I could have anything I wanted. After we checked out, I loved being in the car and having all the books we'd gotten stacked on my lap, pressing me under their solid, warm weight, their Mylar covers sticking a bit to my thighs. It was such a thrill leaving a place with things you hadn't paid for. Such a thrill anticipating the new books we would read. On the ride home, my mom and I talked about the order in which we were going to read our books and how long until they had to be returned, a solemn conversation in which we decided how to pace ourselves through this charmed, evanescent period of grace until the books were due. We both thought all of the librarians at the Bertram Woods Branch Library were beautiful. For a few minutes, we would discuss their beauty. My mother then always mentioned that if she could have chosen any profession at all, she would have chosen to be a librarian. And the car would grow silent for a moment as we both considered what an amazing thing that would have been.
So I have similar memories going to the library with my mother. I have memories of, honestly, even today, just walking into a library, it's the smell that gets me first, that smell. And a library book does not smell like every other book. I don't know what
right.
It is about, they smell different. And yeah, go ahead.
And I also think there's some, certainly this book began for me when I was taking my son to the library and was flooded with the memories of going to the library with my mother. And the library that I was visiting with my son didn't look anything like the Bertram Woods branch, but the smell, the sound, the feeling of it was so, it was so incredibly vivid as a memory of going to the library with my mother. And by the way, where was I last night but at the Bertram Woods Branch Library? And I was actually nervous walking in. I thought, I hope they haven't renovated. It'll ruin it for me. But it was, there was a quality of the feel of Branch Library in particular that triggered all of these memories and made me begin thinking, why are those memories so vivid? Why do we feel such an emotional connection to libraries? Because if you look at it very pragmatically, it's a building with books in it. But that's
books,
not
the
way.
Books you don't get to keep.
And right. And yet we have a feeling about libraries that is so deep and so emotional and so evocative.
And why do you think that is? Because I will say, so my husband, who's we co-produced to the best of our knowledge, so he adores books even more than I do. I mean, he's a book hoarder, but he doesn't like libraries. He insists on buying books. He wants to own them and have them with him always. I can't get the guy into a library. And I don't understand, how could you not like libraries? He says they kind of creep him out.
So, wow.
So what would you say to somebody who doesn't like libraries?
I think we have to work on this. Being creeped out, I don't understand.
Well, I think he doesn't like reading books that other people have touched.
It's interesting because certainly in the early part of the 1900s, there was a lot of fear among the general population that disease could be spread through books. And if you had a contagious disease, you were not allowed to take a book out of the library. Now, I think, I'm not a doctor, but I don't think most germs live on books. But, I mean, books at the library get dirty, of course. They get smudged and spilled and on and so forth. But I think a lot of people find that part of the pleasure. I mean, to me, the worst thing that has happened, well, not the worst, but one of the worst things that's happened in modern times is not having that little checkout card where you could see who else had taken the book out.
Yes, completely
and,
agree.
You know, you could just read through. I mean, because the book in a library has its own story, where it has been,
its lineage.
Who took it home, who read it, who made a little mark on it. But I mean, I certainly own a lot of books and went through an enormous rage for buying books and grew up in a household where we went to the library and my parents thought buying books was a little silly. They just felt, they didn't understand it. Their thought was, you read a book to read it. You don't read a book to have it on a bookshelf. So their attitude was, yes, you can buy books occasionally, but mostly you go to the library. So, of course, like any teenager, the minute I had my own discretionary income, I did exactly what my parents disapproved of, which was start buying books.
My first job was in my public library. It was my, you know, high school teenage job. And I don't know if people know what they call you when you're a young person working in the library. You're a page.
Yeah.
How appropriate is that? And I always wondered, do you get to, like, if you move up, do you become a chapter?
Yeah.
But my favorite thing, so shelving books got kind of old. You know, when you're, like, back in the RSs or something, this was a Library of Congress system, you know, and you're reshelving books about railroads, it just kind of gets boring. But working at the checkout counter and getting to see what people were taking out, that was really interesting. Anyway, so I want to move on to talking about Your book is about one particular library and a library that was destroyed. So tell us how you even came to hear about the LA library fire.
Complete serendipity. I had just moved to LA and I was asked to give a talk for the Friends of the Library. I agreed. It was held at a country club, not in a library. I gave my talk. At the end of the talk, the head of the Friends said he, as a thank you, would like to give me a tour of the downtown library. And I was very excited because I didn't know LA had a downtown. So I accepted enthusiastically and thought this was a sort of mythic journey. A few days later, I met him down, and I immediately fell in love with the library. It's a quite unique piece of architecture, a sort of blend of Egyptian and Art Deco, if you can imagine that. And I loved it. I just thought it was such a totally charming, interesting building. And as we walked through the building, I was quite smitten with the place. He was telling me all the stories of the previous heads of the library and the patrons over the years, and I was very taken with this place. We stopped in front of the fiction section, and he pulled a book off the shelf, and he held it up, and he took a deep whiff of the book. And I didn't know what to do. I thought, I'm new to LA. I don't know if this is
it's a book
sort
fetish.
Of a thing that people do here. And then I thought, do I take that same book and smell it? Or do I like take another book? And I really didn't know what to do. I didn't understand it. He said, you know, you can still smell the smoke in some of them. I said, did they used to let people smoke in the library? He said, no, no, smoke from the fire. And I said, from what fire? And he said, well, from the big fire in 1986. I said, I don't, tell me more. And he said, well, the fire in 86, it closed the library for 7 years. The minute I heard that, and I'd already been toying in my mind with the idea that I wanted to write something about libraries, but it was a very shapeless idea. It was just the thought that libraries were fascinating. Well, the minute I heard that, I thought I have to find out more about this and write about it. And I found out immediately that a number of things. First of all, that it was the largest library fire in American history.
Wow.
It had burned for 7.5 hours and reached over 2,500 degrees. And when it was finally extinguished at the end of those 7 hours, it was determined that 400,000 books had been destroyed.
Wow.
And 700,000 were damaged.
Oh my God.
So it was a catastrophic fire. And it was determined that it was arson.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Susan Orlean talks more about her research into the 1986 Los Angeles Public Library fire for her book, The Library Book.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to Anne Strainchamps, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge, talking with Susan Orlean.
The section where you describe the actual fire, the day of the fire, the fire, the firefighters, the librarians, it's completely riveting. But in your unique Susan Orlean way, you know, you went into great detail about so many aspects of it. And one of them that I really loved and was fascinated by is the fire itself. It was a particular special kind of fire. So could you read that passage? It's on page 25.
Yes, it was really fascinating to begin working on a book about libraries and suddenly be learning a lot about the physics of fire and spending a lot of time with arson investigators and firefighters, and quite fascinating. In the physics of fire, there is a chemical phenomenon known as a stoichiometric condition, in which a fire achieves the perfect burning ratio of oxygen to fuel. In other words, there is exactly enough air available for the fire to consume all of what it is burning. Such a ratio creates an ideal fire situation, which results in total perfect combustion. A stoichiometric condition is almost impossible to create outside of a laboratory. It requires such an elusive, precise balance of fuel and fire and oxygen that, in a sense, is more theoretical than actual. Many firefighters have never seen such a blaze and never will. Not long ago, I had coffee with a man named Ron Hamill. He is now an arson investigator, but at the time of the library fire, he was a captain in the fire department. Although over 30 years have passed, he remains awed by what he saw that day at the library. He talked about it like someone might talk about seeing a UFO. In his decades with the department, Hamill fought thousands of fires, but he said he had never experienced another that was as exceptional as the fire at Central Library. Usually, a fire is red and orange and yellow and black. The fire in the library was colorless. You could look right through it as if it were a sheet of glass. Where the flame had any color, it was pale blue. It was so hot that it appeared icy. Hamill said he felt like he was standing inside a blacksmith's forge. We thought we were looking at the bowels of hell.
Yeah. The most beautiful writing, and that just gives me a chill. I can't, when you said fire that's colorless, that's just stunning.
It was shocking to me. And, you know, I spoke to all of these firefighters, and, you know, they're very used to seeing epic fires, huge fires. And LA, unfortunately, is a city that has many, many fires. Obviously, wildfires, but it has just a very high rate of fire. So these were people who were very accustomed to seeing significant, dramatic fires. And they, to a one, said, I've never seen anything like it. And when you think about it, a library is unfortunately a perfect source of fuel for a fire. It's endless amounts of burnable material. And I should note that in 1986, when the fire occurred, the standard in libraries was to not have a sprinkler system.
Oh, my God.
And it was advised against, specifically advised against, by the American Library Association, because sprinkler systems in 1986 were fairly crude.
Oh.
They could be triggered
accidentally.
And I think librarians are worried about fire. They're more worried about water. Mm. And there was just a great fear that you would trigger a sprinkler system to go off throughout the library. 1986, shortly after the fire, or rather shortly before the fire, the American Library Association for the first time changed their recommendation because fire suppression had improved and it could be in zones. And I think on balance, the thought was it's too dangerous not to have fire suppression. The LA Library not only didn't have sprinklers, which was true everywhere, it also didn't have fire doors, which was in violation of the fire code. It had many fire violations, and it was wildly overcrowded. Hmm. The building was built in the 20s. You can imagine LA in the 20s versus LA in 1986. It multiplied, it metastasized. It was a city that grew like crazy. So this building was much too small. And the fact is, there were books everywhere. They were stacked in the stacks. They were stacked on the staircases. They were stacked under desks. There simply wasn't room. And, you know, that, of course, sets up a situation where you're even more likely to have a problem if a fire breaks out.
So I want to ask a little bit about what happened. But before that, I just want to can we have a little pause to talk about craft just for a moment? Because I'm very curious about your process. It's not immediately obvious to me that somebody who was going to write about a fire would investigate the physics of fire. Tell me about your process for working on a nonfiction book like this.
Well, the way I begin is I'm always drawn to subjects I know nothing about. So for better or worse, it always begins with me diving in as a student. And I just try to learn everything I can, radiating out from the sort of central trigger for the story.
Do you have a method? Do you start at the beginning and then have one of those FBI kind of charts with lines drawn to all the possible of digressions?
Well, in a sense, I do. I take, you've got this little central issue, which is Los Angeles, Central Library fire, arson. So I feel like I have to go in every direction. I learned the history of LA, which I didn't know. And I felt like I couldn't write about the library without knowing some context of the city. I had to learn about the history of libraries. I had to learn about the investigation of this particular fire. So it was like spokes off of this hub. And there was a point where I thought, I'm writing about fire, and I actually have no idea how fire works, and I certainly don't know anything about how an arson investigation works. And I like to write from a sense of authority, so it's hard for me to kind of wing it, to just think, well, I'll have the notes in front of me. I feel like I need to reach a point where I can go from being the student to being the teacher, that I could tell you the story without notes in front of me.
So you could now teach a class about the physics of fire.
Well, I won't go that far, but I will say that for the purposes of the book, I felt like I wanted to feel that I knew the story so well that I could tell it to you, and that's the voice that I want the book to have this, the intimacy of someone saying, tugging on your sleeve, saying, oh, this is an amazing story. Let me tell you what I just learned.
But what's interesting is you gather this enormous, mountain of facts, and you followed multiple timelines and storylines, and then you have to weave it all into one story that holds together. So how do you do that?
Well, that was the big challenge with the book. I felt like I would learn all of these different, another thing I was very interested in was to report on what the day-to-day life of a library was
in the present day. You embedded yourself, right?
Yeah, like I mean, there was a point reporter. Where I said, you should hire me, or failing that, give me staff parking privileges, because I was libraries. No. I mean, sadly, the other thing I learned was where to park for the least amount of money in downtown LA. And I can tell you the answer is nowhere. But, you know, I kept thinking that eventually one storyline and one timeline and one narrative would emerge as being the dominant one. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously the story of the fire was dominant, but each of these other aspects felt so significant and important, and I wanted very much to tell the story of the day-to-day life of a library. I felt like it was hard to make the case that this mattered, this fire mattered, without saying libraries matter and they still matter, that it wasn't just this story that happened 30 years ago and an interesting footnote to history, but rather that it's significant in our day-to-day experience. So I was suddenly faced with what felt like 5 or 6 books. And that was troubling. And eventually I did what was, you know, sometimes it's the thing that's the most obvious and easiest is the correct one, which was realizing that it really was these multiple strands, and mm-hmm. that I had to trust that the reader could move among them and could see why learning the history of LA was meaningful in order to understand what was going on in 1986 in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. and why the fire might have happened, and why libraries still matter, or what libraries in the course of history have been destroyed, mm-hmm. and why we care about a library burning. Mm-hmm. I mean, something as simple as that question. So, I mean, it was a very challenging book to write. The structure was really tough.
You've described it as braiding, which I really love, this idea that you've got these strands and you're weaving them together, and as long as you kind of keep the same colors, you know, it's going to emerge with a pattern.
And it's funny that you say colors, because I color-coded all of the index cards that I was working off of, because, you know, I move back and forth in time quite mm-hmm. a bit, from the present day to far back as Alexandria, to the 80s and the fire itself and the investigation and pursuit of the young man who was arrested mm-hmm. under suspicion of having started the fire.
Okay, so let's talk about him. Because of all the eccentric, interesting characters you bring to life in the book, this guy is just, I'm still not sure what I think about him.
You know, it's interesting, because usually when you have a character in a book, you feel, you have a resolved feeling about, do you like them, do you not like them, are they a good guy, are they a bad guy, particularly in the case of someone who's accused of a crime that is awful. I mean, it's horrible.
Nobody was killed, but hundreds could have been.
Oh, absolutely, and a number of firefighters were injured, luckily. Nobody sustained long-term injuries, but it was $22 million worth of damage, which, by the way, the library had insurance on the building, and the building was in pretty good shape after the fire. The damage was to the books, and the books were not insured. So it was an expensive injury to the city.
So the police did kind of finger somebody.
Who right. Was, so, who the, I mean, this young man made the, I would say, sort of fundamental mistake of telling a lot of people that he had started the fire. I actually learned a lot about crime in the course of working on this book, and I learned, like, number one, don't tell people you did it. Number two,
that.
He ended up producing 7 different alibis, and now I'm very equipped to commit a felony because I know that it's better to have one alibi and not 7. And he was he's a very sympathetic character. He's somebody who everybody who knew him liked him. He was a charming, kind of feckless, blundering, but endearing figure, not evil.
And he was young, right?
He was young. He was in his 20s.
His name was Harry.
Harry Peak. He was an aspiring actor, which doesn't distinguish him from most of Los Angeles in any way.
But there's a photo. He's such a good-looking guy. He's got this gorgeous blonde hair. He's got blue eyes. He's got great bone structure.
I mean, he was somebody who you can understand how he fancied himself an actor. Although one interesting thing that was very poignant was he moved to LA and discovered he had a horrible stage fright, which would be an impediment, I'd say, in becoming an actor. But there was nothing that indicated that he would have done it. And arson is a very strange crime. I mean, there's a certain percentage of people who are pyromaniacs and start fires because of the psychosexual thrill that they get from starting a fire. There are many fires that are set for financial gain. Mm. You know, someone insures a business and then burns it down and gets the insurance money. There are people who who burn something down because they're in a dispute with someone else. He didn't fit any of those categories. So on one hand, it was absolutely puzzling that this young guy who had no history of lighting fires would have suddenly lit such an enormous destructive fire. On the other hand, he knew details about that day that would have been difficult to know if you hadn't been there. So when I began the book, my publisher said to me, "Oh, this is great. You're going to solve the crime, right?" And I said, "Yeah, right. I mean, when you're trying to sell a book, you say yes to everything." And I said, "Yes, absolutely. Don't worry. We got that nailed." Well, very quickly, I learned that arson is the least successfully prosecuted of all felonies, and that I, Nancy Drew, was not going to solve this mystery that had been, you know, pursued for many, many years. But it was also the case that midway through the book, I really found myself torn about whether or not he had done it. So my husband, who is actually very supportive, except when he's not, said to me, "Isn't it going to ruin the book that you don't know for sure if he did start the fire?" And I said,
"Thanks."
No. Yeah, I said, "Thanks." No, I said, but the reality is it's unresolved. Mm-hmm. We don't know. And you know, I don't want to say too much about the specifics for those of you who haven't read the book, because it was a sort of fascinating unfolding story. But I believe that readers are comfortable with ambivalence, because that is really where I ended up.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Susan Orlean talks more about her latest book, The Library Book.
We'll be right back.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Let's return to Anne Strainchamp's conversation with author Susan Orlean.
So why do you think the burning of books is so horrific to us? You know, I was just thinking, like just last week, students at Georgia Southern University, maybe people saw this news report, burned the books of a Cuban-American novelist on a grill while she was visiting. They were protesting what she had been talking about. If they had just shouted her down in the lecture, we wouldn't be reading about it in the national newspapers. It's the fact and the image of her book on a grill that is so viscerally revolting. Why is that?
Books and libraries have a connection to us that is beyond the logical. They exist as a sort of extension of the human mind and spirit. And I think we feel that deeply and feel a connection to books that is not a matter of paper and ink and glue, but as if a book has a soul. And this has been something that philosophers have meditated upon throughout time. I mean, since books existed, there was this feeling that Milton said that a book has the potentiality of human life, that it's just one step removed from human life. The thing about burning books, and I think that there's a visceral level, as you say, where it feels horrifying, because it's an aggressive act of destruction and erasure. It's a way of not only saying, I'm going to throw your book out, it's that I am going to make your book disappear. It's as if you never existed. It's as if your community never existed. And, you know, it's no accident that tyrants throughout human history have burned libraries. And it's partly to rid us of access to knowledge, but it's also a message of saying you are erased. You and your heritage and your community are erased. And it's, you know, the Nazis had a squad that was assigned one mission, which was to seek out and burn libraries, purely for the emotional and psychological terror that it filled people with, that feeling of that's our communal memory, that's who we are, is our library, and it's now being destroyed in a way that is, on a gut level, burning, I think, affects us almost like no other method of destruction.
Yeah. Well, I was also thinking that, I mean, going back to our initial conversation about the magic of libraries and the magic of a book, it really is. I mean, if you're going to write a book, you're putting some of your soul, your thoughts, your who you are in that book. It's become a receptacle for you.
Right.
You know, that's why I think we think of books as sacred objects, and it's also why I think in fairy tales and mythology, folklore, and children's books, there's so many stories about magical books.
Right.
You know, books that can talk, or books that contain the secrets of the world. Or think what witches' spell books are, books whose words could change the world if you just read them out loud.
Yeah. Well, and I also think that at the base of that is the fact that books are immortal. So yeah. Books can be the one thing that we can't be, which is that they can contain our thoughts in a permanent, immortal form. And that, I think, when you walk into a library, part of the feeling that you get is that you are surrounded by these voices throughout history that have remained eternal, even though the writers are long gone. So there is a kind of mystically potent quality that a book has. I mean, it really feels like a voice talking to you that will live on. And that's why I think the destruction of a library is such a disturbing, deeply emotional and horrifying experience for a community.
And I'm thinking, I can think of fiction writers who've written about libraries as if the libraries themselves were alive, you know, from J.K. Rowling to Jorge Luis Borges.
Right.
You know, it's just like libraries that whisper and talk to you.
And they do. I mean, whether you go that extra step of seeing this sort of mystical, spiritual aspect of it, there's no question that it's a place filled with voices and that those voices live on in a way that is more than human. It's superhuman. It's eternal life in a way that is kind of marvelous.
Isn't there an African proverb, something like, when an old man dies, a library burns?
That became the kind of organizing principle of the book to me. I had come across that expression. I wasn't sure that I completely understood it. So I wrote it on an index card and I had it hanging over my desk, and I would look at it occasionally and think, I still don't get it. And about halfway through working on the book, my mother was diagnosed with dementia. And suddenly I began understanding the meaning of that proverb, that her internal library was burning down, that her memories, her knowledge was disappearing almost volume by volume. And what you lose with one person's mind is as big as a library. And similarly, a library is a communal mind. So when you lose a whole library, you lose this shared mind of a society.
Mm. There's a section in your book when I wondered if you would, I'd love to hear you read it, if you wouldn't mind, when you talk about, it's not just the Nazis who burned books. That World War II also destroyed so many libraries. I haven't heard anybody really describe the damage to books that World War II did, and by extension, all wars do, in quite the way you do.
And I have to say, I was shocked, I mean, almost speechless as I was doing this research. I had no idea of the enormity of the loss of books. The grinding destruction of the war crushed the libraries of Europe. Some were merely unlucky and got caught in firebombings and aerial attacks meant for more strategic targets. But the German army singled out books for destruction. Special book burning squads, known as Bren Commandos, were sent out to burn libraries and synagogues. The squads were effective, enumerating the losses of libraries in the war, both incidental and purposeful, is dizzying. 20 major libraries containing 2 million books were destroyed in Italy. France lost millions more, including 300,000 in Strasbourg, 42,000 in Beauvais, 23,000 in Chartres, and 110,000 in Douai. The Library of the National Assembly in Paris burned down, taking with it countless historic arts and science books. In Metz, officials hid the library's most valuable books in an unmarked warehouse for safekeeping. A German soldier found the warehouse and threw an incendiary device into it. Most of the books, including rare 11th and 13th century manuscripts, were destroyed. During the Blitz, 20 million books in Great Britain burned or were wrecked by the water used to extinguish the fires. The Central Lending Library in Liverpool was completely ruined. The rest of the city's libraries stayed open throughout the Blitz, maintaining regular hours and levying the usual overdue fines.
The indomitable Brits.
I know. I actually found that strangely heartening to think that, I mean, this the amount of destruction was so astonishing.
Well, and in the next paragraph, you also lay some of the blame on the Allies. Germany lost a ton of books.
I don't remember. It was, yeah. There was a point where, I won't be able to pull this out quickly, but Theodore Welch, who studied libraries in Japan, said that by the time the American army arrived, three quarters of all the books in Japan's libraries had been burned or damaged. The losses in Germany were astonishing. Most of the library books in cities including Bremen, Stuttgart, Leipzig, Dresden, Munich, Hanover, and Hamburg were incinerated. Three quarters of a million were destroyed in Darmstadt, forgive my pronunciation, more than a million books in Frankfurt, 2 million in Berlin. By the end of the war, more than one third of all the books in Germany were gone.
Wow.
Yeah, and you know, some of it, as I said, was you're bombing the center of a city, libraries mm-hmm. are in the center of many cities, and it's inevitable, but it was also often effortful, and you know, there was a purpose to it. To, I mean, among other things too, people feel libraries are safe right. places, and the image of a library burning makes you feel that there nowhere is safe if a library isn't safe.
Some of the most poignant scenes to me in the book are about the librarians who worked in that LA library and saw the library burn. Many of them stood there for the whole 7 hours watching it, heartbroken, and who then spent, you know, all those following years doing what they could to kind of save some of the books or to, you know, yeah. I mean, can you talk more about the librarians themselves?
Well, they really were amazing. I mean, for them, it was utterly devastating. And the city employed a psychologist to meet with them and work with them because people were traumatized. I mean, I think a lot of us forget that librarians don't just check out books. In fact, they usually aren't the ones checking out the books. It's usually a clerk. But librarians build collections. I mean, they see the library as their, they've curated, they've, you know, produce these collections. So for them, it was devastating, but also they were, in many cases, horrified at the thought of all the patrons who would have nowhere to go, and no one knew when the library would reopen. And many of them transferred to other branches. There was eventually a temporary library that opened up downtown. But it was a terrible time for them. And
I mean, you said some of the marriages broke up. People had, you know, physical illnesses.
It was really a form of PTSD. I think they really suffered and took it very personally. many of them then got involved in the kind of amazing process of restoring those 700,000 books that were damaged, which had been put in cold storage for six, they had to be frozen solid or they would mold because, wow. You know, they were wet. And you either have to dry a book within 48 hours or it's going to mold and it'll be ruined forever. So if you can't dry it quickly, you have to freeze it. So
then what happens after you've frozen it?
That's a good question. My first question was, who has a freezer big enough for 700,000 books? I mean, and actually it was a matter of, you know, the city had to scramble and they contacted all these frozen food warehouses and said, can we store some books? This is how I picture the conversation. Can we store some books for a couple days? And then it's like, here are 700,000 books for 7 years.
And they're calling bird's
eye.
Yes,
yes.
And could you move the frozen peas aside?
And that's exactly what happened. And, you know, I was saying to somebody, do any of the books smell like broccoli? Because they were stored next to frozen food for 7 years. But then it's a very complicated thing. These books had soaked up hundreds of gallons of water. So McDonnell Douglas and the Jet Propulsion Lab got involved in trying to figure out how do we dry these books. So they undertook what was a very lengthy, fascinating, complicated effort. And the amazing thing is that they were largely successful.
Wow.
They were able, and you know, I wrote a lot about the process because it was so interesting to me. I mean, they took the books, put them on pallets, and then exposed, they put them in chambers that are used to test the equipment that goes into outer space. And they could raise and lower the air pressure dramatically. And I guess, and you can tell I skipped science when I was in high school, but it causes the water to express itself out of the book.
All right, Susan, it has been absolutely a pleasure talking with you on behalf
of
Traverse City. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
That was Susan Orlean talking with Anne Strainchamps. Susan Orlean's latest book is called The Library Book. Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economic ecology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org, and listen to past programs at interlockinpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.